Well, I get the strangest inspiration for these different types of series I develop and stuff. And one day I was laying in bed, waking up, and I don't know why, Cyndi Lauper's song, Time After Time, popped into my head. And it was one of those mental worms, you know, that kept playing in my head all day long. And then I thought about this year, 2025. It's been 50 years since I came to an understanding of the grace found in Jesus Christ. 50 years. I don't know where the time's gone, honestly, but I thought to myself, boy, the gospel of Christ that I was introduced to back in 1975 was such a welcome invitation into love. I'm not sure we can see that happening today. And I asked myself, what on earth changed over the last 50 years within Christianity? And so I want to do kind of a retrospective of the last 50 years. I'm kind of intersperse a little bit of personal history along with some insights sociologically and spiritually of where the church has been and where it might be going into the future. And so bear with me over the next 3 weeks. I'm going to talk a little bit about 50, 25, and 10. 50 years ago, this is what I experienced. 25 years ago, this is what I experienced within Christianity. And 10 years ago, this is what I experienced. We're all in the process of development. We're all in the process of changing. That's true mentally. That's true spiritually. That's true physically. And none of us are the same as we were decades before. And we look back, and I don't know about you, but what I say to myself sometimes is, boy, I wish I knew now back then. You know, I wish I could have the insight back then that I have now on certain things. So I want to talk about 50 years, and the first 50 years I want to talk about is the fear of the future. The fear of the future. It seems that's embedded inside of all of us. What does tomorrow hold? Am I going to be able to, number one, survive? Number two, am I able to thrive in some way when I don't know what's around the next corner? Well, I'm going to use a few pictures here that are on the right side of the screen, and they will be kind of the parameters to tell you a little bit about how I first experienced Christianity. So this is the house I grew up in. 710 Damon Street, Akron, Ohio, North Hill neighborhood, which was a lower middle class Italian neighborhood. Now, most of the friends that I had in the neighborhood, being Italian, went down to St. Martha's Catholic Church, but I didn't. I grew up in an unchurched home. Not that it was some type of pagan palace or something. It was just that my parents never went to church, and so we never went to church. And as a result of that, I mean, I didn't know much about God at all. And as a result of that, I, you know, just basically never gave it a second thought. But I had a good friend that went to a church just a couple doors up from our house. And during our senior year of high school, he invited me to go to the youth group there and enjoy some of the activities that were there. And so I look back, and I remember with fondness that initial entrance into the journey of faith. And as I look back, I say, where did all those years go? I mean, it just seems like yesterday that I had that top floor bedroom there, okay? And it made me think about Job chapter 7, verse 6. Job says, my days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle. They come to an end without hope. Now, Job had some particular circumstances that he had to endure. Obviously, physically and psychologically, he went through a lot of trauma. But he gives us an image of a weaver's shuttle that has a tool that you push across to continue to weave a fabric. And he says, that's how life is. It's as fast as that weaver's shuttle as you throw that, and all of a sudden there goes another year and another year and another year. And all of a sudden you look back and you go, where did all the years go? Well, for Job, he didn't know what was up around the corner, and he didn't know that in the end his health would be restored. He didn't know that some of his fortunes would be restored to him. For him, it was bleak. His days were going to end without hope because, after all, he had just lost his kids. He had lost his livestock. He lost his house, and then he lost his health. And if you ever want to read, boy, a sad account of that, there's 42 chapters of his misery in the book of Job, okay? But it's all poetry, and it has insights here and there that produce wisdom for us to how to approach the future. Well, I look back on the 70s, and it was a very chaotic time. The 1970s, coming out of the 60s, was a time of war and racism and high taxes and inflation and demonstrations and the hippie movement and Volkswagen buses and long hair and flower power, okay? And there was a lot going on inside the hearts of people during that time. What does the future hold? And am I going to be drafted and sent off to the Vietnam War? Is the Soviet Union going to invade countries and try to produce a communistic takeover? And the Cold War is thriving. And then you have the racial tensions that were going on in the country. I remember, this is more toward the end of the 60s than in the 70s, when the city of Akron put a curfew on the city that you had to be off the streets by 8 o'clock at night because there were riots that were going on in the city. And this racial tension and this international tension and all of this kind of produced a world where people were looking for hope, and how can they find hope? Because as Barry McGuire sang during that day, it seemed as though we were on the eve of destruction.
The Eastern world, it is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on destruction. Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save with the world in a grave. Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Yeah, out, my blood's so mad, feels like coagulating. I'm sitting here just contemplating. I can't twist the truth, it knows no regulation. Handful of senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Think of all the hate there is in Red China, then take a look around to Selma, Alabama. You may leave here for 4 days in space, but when you return, it's the same old place. The pounding of the drums, the pride and disgrace. You can bury your dead, but don't leave a trace. Hate your next door neighbor, but don't forget to say grace and tell me.
And I heard a voice in the midst of the four beasts, and I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and his name that sat on him was Death, and Hell followed with him.
So that video highlights a song that was popular in the early 70s as a new spiritual interest began to percolate inside the souls of people to try to find some hope somewhere in light of all the death, in light of all the confusion, in light of all the hopelessness. And there were little ministries that had the opportunity to make a difference. It was the best of times, and it was the worst of times. Charles Dickens talked about that in his writings, but coming out of the turbulent 60s, it wasn't much better at the beginning of the 70s. Remember what Dickens said, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, it was the age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief, and it was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. We had everything before us. We had nothing before us. We were all going direct to heaven. We were all going direct the other way. In short, the period was so far like the present period that some of its noisiest authorities insisted on its being received for good or for evil in the superlative degree of comparison only. A Tale of Two Cities. Well, we did survive, didn't we? Here we are, 50 years later. But a lot of this stuff is continuing to be repeated. It's still this age of foolishness, and it's affecting the epic of belief. But little churches sometimes can make a difference. This is before the boom of mega churches. This was before pastors became celebrities. This is before media put televangelists on TV and promised things for donations. It was small little churches like this one, two doors up from where I lived. Strangest place in the world for a church. On a side street, not on a main road, on a side street. Everything else around it is residential, and there's this small church, Forest Hill Community Church, and it was a place I was introduced to Christ. It's where I went to youth group back in 1975, And it was there I was introduced to the hope that is beyond this world, the person of Jesus Christ. And it helped bring some community in chaotic times. One of the things that happens in most people's life is they have a period of time that shaped them significantly. And this was mine. There was an experience of community there that I have not seen replicated in the last 50 years. There was a true sense of interest in each other. There was a true sense of love beyond convenience. And in that small little youth group, there was a bond. It's sort of what Jesus was talking about, to love each other, to serve each other. The world will know you are my followers by the love that you have for one another. The most significant thing that happened in my life that put me on a track toward the ministry was during my high school years, my buddy Stan and I, we asked these girls out on a date. And we went to see the movie Jaws at the time. How ignorant we were not to take them to a rom-com, right? I was driving a 1964 Ford Galaxy 500. The thing was as big as the Titanic. Three on the column. No power steering. But you could fit 12 kids into that car if you wanted to, yeah? And we went to the Chapel Hill Mall. We watched the movie, and we were on our way home. If you've ever driven through Akron, you'll say this is the worst city to drive in the world, because the roads go everywhere. There's potholes everywhere. And there's crazy drivers as well. But if you ever drive down Route 8 south, you'll come to what I call the Central Interchange. And it's a clover leaf, really, that can take you west or east, or you can continue south, that type of thing. And these girls lived in Ellet. And so that's going east on 76, and I'm driving, and I come to the clover leaf, and as I am circling the clover leaf, you have to look kind of in your side mirror to see any oncoming traffic so that you don't, you know, cause an accident and so forth. And as I was doing so, I was looking in the side mirror for oncoming traffic, and there was a young man that was running across the freeway. His car broke down on the main part of the freeway. And because it was a curve on the clover leaf, he didn't see my car coming around. And so when I looked up from the side mirror, there's this guy in front of me, and I clipped him on the knee, and he was thrown probably about 50 feet out in front of the car. I was able to get the car stopped, and the four of us got out, and here's this young man that's laying in the center of the freeway, and he's not moving. And I was overwhelmed with the fact that I thought I killed somebody. And finally, the police were called, ambulance was called, he was taken to a hospital. And as it turned out, a few inches makes a big difference. Because all it did was it kind of threw him up and out. Another couple of inches, he would have been hit head on, right? But that started to get me thinking. I was having fun with youth group activities and so forth, but here's the question that popped in my mind. If that was me laying down in the freeway there, what happens after this? Right? Well, as it turns out, good news. The man was in the hospital a few days and had some broken bones, and he not only survived, he was okay. But I wasn't okay. I had changed. And I think I took seriously at that moment what I had been hearing in youth group and the youth leaders that were there about the significance of knowing not only this time, but the time after this time, right? Now, if you know anything about the 70s, fear was in the heart of everyone, and it seemed as though religion kind of compounded that as well, because there was the desire to get people to convert to Christianity, and the best way to do that is to cause fear. Do you know where you're going? You know, if you were to die tonight, all that type of thing. And it's just where the society was at that time. And so there was a strong emphasis on evangelism, and there was a growing movement toward foreign missions out of churches just like this one. But what you find is that something happened between the 60s and the 70s, and it's summarized in two covers of Time magazine. The first one was published on April the 8th, 1966. Time magazine put on the front cover this question: is God dead? Does religion have any relevance anymore? Or should we just throw it away with the trash, take it out and put it on the curb? Well, something was happening because of the way the world was, especially in young people. And it began out in California, and it was called the Jesus Movement. And it began in a small church out in California, and you might hear the name Chuck Smith or Lonnie Frisbee sometime, and these hippies began to gather out in California and began to renew a desire to know Christ. And you fast forward and you'll find that this same magazine, only a few years later, saw a huge, huge change had taken place. Young people began to kind of reshape the religion of their parents. New type of songs, new type of communities. They were concerned about our planet. Most of them were anti-Vietnam War. Most of them were pro-civil rights. And they began to push back on the political and the way it was being conducted at that time. And they made a difference, and a movement began to move across the United States from California, and it's made its way into every state. And we find this happening here. Born out of the fear of the future came a movement of people that found hope in Christ and trust that God could do something to change the world around them. And there's that 1964 Ford Galaxy I was telling you about. And these are some friends out at a Forest Hill retreat we had. And it's there, and you can find me in that picture. Isn't that a typical album cover from a 1970s album, right? But the Jesus Movement was kind of summarized in looks like that. And music, and I was talking to you last week, like Second Chapter of Acts and other groups that began to introduce new ways of expressing their faith. And movements began. The only problem was this: there was still the fear of the future. And somehow religion added to that fear because they forgot to leave behind and press on toward what comes. I read for you earlier Philippians chapter 3. The Apostle Paul, he had a religious upbringing. He was a religious scribe. He was a Pharisee. He was well educated. He was influential. He was an individual that pushed against this new movement of his day, the church, and he tried to stamp it out. But he met Christ on a road called Damascus. And it was there his heart was changed because he took seriously this defining moment in his life. And he began to do a turnaround, and the story of his life is found in the book of Acts. And what we find is that he writes this from prison, actually. He became so zealous about his newfound faith in Christ that he was arrested by the Roman authorities. He was placed in a house arrest situation, and he wrote what's called the prison epistles, of which Philippians is one of them. And this is what he says about himself: not that I have already attained all of this, this power of the resurrection, or have already arrived at my goal, but I press on to take hold of that for which Christ took hold of me. Brothers and sisters, I do not consider myself to have taken hold of it, but one thing I do, I forget what lies behind, and I strain on to what lies ahead. And sometimes that's what happens in religion. You get stuck in the past because you're comfortable with it, and you don't press on toward the changes that God wants to make in you, through you, and into society. And so this fear causes different types of reaction. You've heard of probably two of them. When you are afraid, you either fight or flight, right? But there's a third. It's frozen, that you just freeze in place and you don't continue to move forward. During the 1970s, there really was a fear-based understanding of God. There was these remnants of hellfire and brimstone that was preached from the pulpits. And there were people that emerged during that era, the Billy Grahams of the world, that were evangelists, that held crusades and called for people to make a decision in their mind and to walk forward to an altar. And I'm not putting that down. Many people found Christ in situations like that. But it was all based on fear, which is based on a biblical interpretation of a particular couple of passages. And I think one of the things that happened is this fear that is still resident within the souls of the people at the time was used by religion in some way to herd the flock and to grow the flock, and then televangelists began to try to use the flock to gain money and get rich. And so what happened was a particular theology grabbed hold of that era. It was end time obsession in the 1970s. There was a book that was published by this man here, Hal Lindsey, who was one of those media figures. He has passed away, but he was an individual that wrote a book. It's called The Late Great Planet Earth, that was built upon the fear that was resident inside the hearts of all people. What's going to happen to this world? And what do the scriptures say about the future? And can we predict the future? And prophecy became an obsession. There were prophecy conferences. There were prophecy books that were written. This book here sold over 15 million copies. 15 million. Now, his particular approach was rather new. This idea of end-time theologies that you could predict the future and you could avoid the horrors that were awaiting planet Earth because you had the knowledge to do that, this particular approach is only a couple hundred years old. The early church didn't believe any of this stuff. But this was kind of developed and it took hold, and everyone then became kind of Israel obsessed, that God was not done with Israel, and they got to go back to their land, and they got to rebuild a temple, and they got to reinstitute sacrifices, all this type of thing. And when you take that approach, then, what happens many times is an end-time theology develops, and that really is the basis of the evangelical movement of the last 50 years. Evangelicals turn to prophecy conference, curriculum, and media to sort through the crisis of the times and the promise of the second coming of Christ. An emphasis was placed on the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation and a particular way of interpreting those two books. And everything was read through literalism. Some of the crazy symbols that we used, even in our dragon study this past time, was taken as literal rather than symbol of a significant insight or wisdom. And the term that was used for it was apocalyptism. And that is, you've heard of the apocalypse. Movies are built on that, right? The coming apocalypse. And it became a lens, really, for interpreting world events in this time of uncertainty. So now Christians want to make sense of the world that they're living in, and as a result of it, they turn to this theology to try to interpret it. They try to make sense of war and economic turmoil and societal shifts, and all of a sudden there was introduced a particular belief called the rapture of the church. Things are going to get so bad, but never fear. God's going to take you out of it. He's going to rapture you out. Now, there are certain teachings in the Bible that are like skyscrapers that have been built on one verse, okay? And that's the rapture, okay? One verse in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, which I think is contextual and cultural, but that's another story. Okay, so then artists began to reinforce this teaching through songs and through contemporary Christian music. And one of those artists was Larry Norman. And he wrote and sung a song called "I Wish We'd All Been Ready." And it's this idea, what if the rapture happens today? And it instilled fear in people. You'd come home and your mom and dad weren't home and you go, were they raptured? Its house is empty, you know. Oh, then they came back and they go, oh, no, we were at the grocery store. That type of thing. But this is a little bit cheesy video. But it was the mentality of the time. Watch.
Mind, the sun has come and you've been left behind. wish we'd all been ready. There's no time to change your mind. How could you have been so blind? The Father spoke, the demons dined. The Son has come, and you've been left behind. You've been left behind. You've been left behind. You've been left behind. You've been left
So, fear-induced, religion-enforced, theology gives explanation or reason for it. So from that then came all kinds of charts, figuring out where we are in the timeline of things and when the rapture's going to come and when Christ is going to come again. And these type of charts were everywhere in the 70s. Everywhere. I mean, they became an art form. There's a guy by the name of Clarence Larkin that made the end time scenarios colorful, and you take hours and look at this and try to figure all of this stuff out, right? No one ever told us, me included, there are other ways of looking at things. There's other ways of interpreting things. So I felt this call to go into ministry. And of course, I went where I had opportunity to go based upon what I cut my teeth on, which was a lot of this type of thing. And I went to schools that reinforced it and didn't give other viewpoints, that type of thing. So then all of a sudden, it became a cottage industry. We can build on these fears. Jerry Jenkins and Tim LaHaye put out 10 books of Left Behind and end time scenarios, and they're all fiction. I mean, if you want to read them as fiction, great, read them as fiction, but they're not prediction. Are you following what I'm saying? They're not telling us what's going to happen in the future. So you have a cottage industry that saw a lot of money to be made. And so all these books are written. And of course, traditional churches that was built on scholarship, they were considered liberal. Don't read that, right? Don't you dare open your thinking to something other than just this peephole to look through. So what happened? In the last 50 years, the church never stopped to ask what Pete Enns asks almost every week in his podcast. What is the Bible and what do we do with it? Is the Bible a cookbook for any topic? You find ingredients there to figure out how the end should be? Or is it an anthology of different voices from different cultures and different times, enabling us to gather wisdom from their desire to connect with the divine? And I think if you understand that it is an anthology, more than a perfect book that is a prescription for the end times, then all of a sudden, you begin to read it with a different lens. So maybe the church forgot something along the way. I am always thankful for the Jesus movement and for the introduction of Christianity into my life. However, the church forgot that God is love, and that God's love casts out fear, doesn't produce it. That's what John says. If anyone confesses that Jesus is the Son of God, God abides in him and he in God, and we have come to know and believe the love that God has for us. God is love. Whoever abides in love abides in God and God in him. And in this way, love has been perfected among us so that we may have confidence on the day of judgment. For in this world, we are just like him. There's no fear in love, but perfect love drives out fear because fear involves punishment. The one who fears has not been perfected in love. We love because he first loved us. It doesn't depend on me figuring everything out. It doesn't depend on me being perfect. It doesn't depend on me. It depends on his love and his grace and his forgiveness and his joy. Are you following what I'm saying? And when that fills your heart, you can love the rest of the world with a love that God instills inside us. So maybe on this St. Patrick's Day Eve, we should remember this Irish proverb. May you never forget what is worth remembering, nor ever remember what is best forgotten. Stand with me, please, as we close. Father, some of what we talked about today is personal, some of it is perplexing, and some of it is mysterious. Your Spirit working in this world, in your time, and in your way, is not controlled by human behavior, but on your time clock. And so time after time, as we've seen you work throughout the centuries, we realize that the things that are going on around us are still within your control, and help us to have confidence to keep on loving, to keep on smiling, and to keep on serving. Because in the end, the kingdom of God will overtake the kingdoms of this world. Be with us during this turbulent time of life here on earth. We're asking you to help us not to use it or abuse it, but to help us to simply be available to other people that needs to hear a word of hope. I thank you for this opportunity that we've had to be here together. In Jesus' precious name I pray. Amen. Thanks, everyone. Have a happy St. Patrick's Day, okay? See you next week.